Hello and welcome back. I have another wonderful episode brought to you by the University of Sydney, their Brain and Mind Centre, in conjunction with BHP Foundation's Right Care First Time Where You Live program. I have returning to the podcast. You may remember last year I recorded with the wonderful Andrew Shim and Rachel Ledler on the history of mental health advocacy. And I have the wonderful Andy returning today to talk about autism and neurodivergence and the role in which that disability, I guess, plays with mental health and the interaction there. That's the baseline. We then take it up the next step or down the next step, or we go the next step deeper, I guess I should say. And we talk about those principles that we're trying to address at the Brain and Mind Centre with the Right Care First Time Where You Live. Their navigation, their accessibility and coordination, their empowerment, and their how to sustain these decisions and these services to allow an individual to thrive, not just at the time of access, but throughout life. Andy and I traverse so many varying topics and sort of theories, from queer theory to the medical versus social model, social and human rights model of disabilities. He is just a brilliant fount of knowledge, particularly when it comes to stats. And so we talk about things like the community awareness needed around suicides and shorter lifespans and mortality rates. We talk about the onus as well of how we are letting our fellow disabled community members down with accessibility, environment, awareness, and shifting that blame to it being purely for the individual to face and not just us as a society or us as a community. I really hope you enjoy this conversation. I really enjoyed having it with Andy, and I look forward to playing in your ears sometime soon. Thank you so much for joining me, Andy. It's been a pleasure getting to know you over, I guess it's kind of been almost 18 months, I think, since we first met on the Gold Coast at the International Association of Suicide Prevention last year. And at that, I think we had a conversation at a bar after one of the nights or something. And it was really interesting to sort of not just get to know you in the sense of what you want to be doing and your advocacy, but also get to know you as a person and what interests you and what makes up you, if that makes you up. So did you want to introduce yourself a little, where you're coming from, you know, something interesting about yourself, and we'll dive in?
Well, firstly, time is definitely, I think, a flat circle at this point. I believe the last time you and I were on a podcast together would have been just over a year ago now.
Yeah. I was recording it on the floor of my bedroom, I remember.
And we were just talking about such a wonderfully light topic, you know, like lobotomy.
Lobotomy, right back to the Egyptian days too.
Yes, and you know, that lovely thing called an asylum. We were just, you know, standard Saturday conversation. It was like yesterday.
It was lighthearted. It was definitely something, but also definitely something that needed to be talked about. And I've actually had so much feedback on that episode that people who are advocates or are just interested generally in mental health found those sort of those notes and those facts and that comprehensive history of like, oh, right, so this is where it stems from. And also the uptake of the idiom, nothing about us without us, from mental health, but stemming right back. So I think to the Latin. So I think it was a super interesting episode.
Well, thank you very much for the feedback. My mic quality has definitely improved since then. So I think
I can tell.
Oh, 100%. She's upgraded now. So we're in for a good ride today.
So what do you do in your day? Like, what's your regular day look like, day job, etc.?
Well, a little bit about me is that I am a member of the Lived Experience Working Group. with the lovely Samuel here. So one of the youth research consultants, as a young person with lived experience of mental ill health. But I'm also a proudly queer autistic person of color and an autistic member of the National Autism Strategy Oversight Council, which is overseeing the National Autism Strategy, the development thereof. We're currently, as of recording today, in the final stages of the first round of community consultations, but there will be other rounds of consultation upcoming. So we're very keen to have discussions like the one today to, you know, help elucidate the intersections between mental health and neurodiversity and where the strategy could help contribute to that.
That's huge. And particularly pertaining to today's conversation, and I guess, you know, why we wanted to somewhat open up this can of worms that just does need to be sorted and does need to be addressed. There's been some pretty big recent news in the autism world, particularly within Australia and policy and guidance. Are you able to fill us in on that?
Gosh, I would say...
easy task.
Oh, so easy. I would say that we are at a critical and exciting juncture, a pivot point in the disability sector as a whole. For example, the ADHD inquiry from the Senate is now wrapping up. The Disability Royal Commission has released its final report with over 220 recommendations, a little bit of light reading, if you will.
Saturday evening.
100%, you know, just a standard Hermione Granger evening. And really interestingly, since we've last spoken, the ACT government has announced that it is in the initial consultation phase for an ACT neurodiversity strategy, which means that, yes, it is a big wow, which means that the ACT will be now joining South Australia and Victoria in having a state/territory-based autism strategy as well. So exciting news all around.
Yeah. And so what are some of the highlights, particularly of the most recent ACT one, but then also going back to the 200-point recommendation list, what are some of the key highlights, I guess, that you see as an individual identifying within the autism sort of community see as something that's really pertinent and something that is finally being addressed or recommended?
Well, the first and I would say most pertinent point is that there is finally, I believe, community awareness and attention to what has ultimately been a invisible epidemic of suicides within the autistic community. What we know from the Senate Select Committee on Autism's report that was released, I believe, prior to the current National Autism Strategy's development, what we know from that inquiry is that autistic Australians have a life expectancy 20 to 35 years shorter than that of the general population, with over 2 times the mortality rate. What we know from that inquiry is that autistic people are 5 times more likely to have suicidal ideation or have survived a suicide attempt than their non-autistic counterparts. What we know from that inquiry is that one study noted that 9 out of 10 autistic women have experienced sexual assault. And what we've heard from these really sobering statistics is that there is systemic and structural discrimination, exclusion, and alienation experienced by the autistic community, which is leading to poorer health outcomes, especially mental health outcomes. And I think what is encouraging about the news from the ACT is that jurisdictions such as the ACT government, South Australia, and Victoria are beginning to recognize that this hidden epidemic should no longer be hidden and should be discussed in the forefront, and that therefore, once it's no longer hidden, we can begin to start actualizing the requisite changes.
So Would you say that with autism there is a fair, obviously given that suicides are, you know, five times more likely, or suicide ideations, experiences, you know, generally within the suicide world, there's a twice the mortality rate, there's 20 to 30 years in lifespan shorter than the average individual or Australian. What does that mean for the impact on mental health? Is there a, is there a higher rate of mental health challenges or mental health amongst the autism community? Is it just as much, or is it more prevalent, I guess, in the experiences?
Thank you for that question. I guess the first thing I would describe is, or rather the first thing I would address is, what is autism? For me, autism is a condition that impacts communication and how we navigate the sensory world around us. So for me, I like to say that because of my autism, I can catch what other people miss and can miss what other people catch.
I was hoping you'd say that.
It's a line that I've used in quite a number of settings, because it's quite apt in my opinion.
Yeah, and incredibly eloquent in the delivery of it too.
It's not better or worse. It doesn't mean that I'm better or worse than anyone else. It just means I'm different. The DSM-5 categorizes it as a neurodevelopmental condition. I think it's very important to note that whilst many people would characterize and describe autism as a mental illness, many other people do not. It is, under the DSM-5, a psychiatric diagnosis. But I think what's really important to note is that a lot of the suicidality that autistic people are experiencing, a lot of the anxiety and depression that autistic people are experiencing, is not because of their autism, but because of the adverse life experiences that is in turn creating co-occurring symptoms of depression and anxiety. It's much like how I would say in the early 60s, or under, say, like DSM-3, homosexuality used to be characterized as a mental illness, until people one day realized, hang on, maybe being gay isn't actually intrinsically depressing. We're just depressing them by putting them in depressing situations.
Yes.
And I would say, in terms of the mental health aspect, is that because it is a neurodevelopmental condition and it is a psychiatric diagnosis according to the DSM-5, in order to access the supports that are evidence-based or person-centered, a person must often access a psychiatrist or a psychologist to get that diagnosis. And a lot of those barriers to accessing supports happens because of what we would describe as sector-wide issues with inaccessible mental health. And this is not just exclusive to mental health. Not just exclusive to autism. I would say this is something we're seeing in the youth mental health sector as a whole.
And I guess that's why the University of Sydney Brain and Mind Centre, where, you know, I work, and you're one of the lived experience working group members and advocates and all sorts of things you're involved in with BMC, is why we have the program Right Care First Time Where You Live, because it's, you know, it's purely about meeting the individual wherever they are and increasing the accessibility and the coordination of those services, just like you were saying, because not just because they are, or there is a lacking within the autism world, but also just generally the youth mental health world.
Very much so. And it's been a great privilege and honor for me to work alongside people like yourself, because I'm not just an autistic person. I do also have lived experience of mental ill health. I am quite proud of the fact that I'm a person with a psychosocial disability. I choose not to be ashamed of the fact that I have PTSD. But for me, my PTSD is different to my autism. I'm not saying one is better or worse. I do think they are distinct entities. And for me, understanding the distinctions between the two and the overlaps between them would ensure that we're not doing a disservice to either one of them. I like to think that the current approach that we have, which is that we don't acknowledge that potential interface between the disability sector and the mental health sector, that lack of acknowledgement of that interface, what it is doing is creating what researchers have called the dual burden of health system costs. So in the Victorian parliamentary inquiry into services for people with autism, they found that young autistic people are 10 times more likely to be admitted to hospitals for medical illnesses and complaints, with psychiatric admission being the number one or one of the number one causes of admission. Now, a big part of this is because a lot of these autistic people and neurodivergent people were not able to access a psychiatrist or a psychologist in the community. And the psychologist or the psychiatrist that they were able to access has not been adequately trained in autism. What this now does is that because there is a lack of, let's say, youth mental health services that are able to help young autistic people, and because there are a lack of youth mental health services which are resourced and trained to help young autistic people, this then in turn contributes to the backlogs experienced in emergency rooms and in those acute health settings, where a lot of neurodivergent people, if they had access to other forms of care in the community, they would not be in those hospital rooms. And if they were not in those hospital rooms, we would have more beds for everybody else. Therefore, it's creating a dual burden in that in order to resolve one problem, we have to also acknowledge the other one as well and solve them both simultaneously.
And so these recent reports and Royal Commissions, when it comes to mental health and things like accessibility and like you just noted, the, I guess, the early intervention or prevention of the hospitalizations and dual burden that can happen to primary services, and not just secondary services, what sort of enlightening points have come out of these reports when it comes to, I guess, that navigation of individuals with autism and or mental health, but I guess, you know, in relation to this podcast, mental health, what does that mean for them when it comes to the potential uptake of those 200 recommendations or the change in ACT policy, et cetera?
I think the National Autism Strategy that we're currently co-designing and co-developing is a huge part to how we intend to remedy some of these issues. Firstly, the National Autism Strategy, we have divided it into four domains with four working groups. So we have one for social inclusion, another for economic inclusion, one for diagnoses, supports and services, and a fourth one on health and mental health of autistic Australians. And each working group is tasked with examining, co-developing some actions and solutions for each of those domains. Now, let's zero in a little bit on the fourth one I mentioned, which is health and mental health. Encouragingly, the health and mental health roadmap for autistic Australians, it has been a great privilege for me to witness the development of this roadmap. The Department of Health and Aged Care has been working with the Department of Social Services to ensure that this roadmap has a whole of government support that is also whole of life and whole of spectrum. What that means is that mental health supports are not just considered merely through a medical lens of how many beds do we have in hospitals, how many diagnosticians do we have trained in these things, which is important, but we're also considering it through the lens of what sort of policies do we have regarding accessible buildings? Are the buildings that are being designed for government, whether it's the Department of the Attorney General or the Department of Health, are those buildings designed to be wheelchair accessible? Are they designed to be autism friendly, whereby the lights overhead are not so fluorescent that you get a headache?
Yeah, as you can see in the background of my office, or the office where I work.
Oh, look, I think the lighting that you're in is okay. I'm talking about emergency room lighting, which can only be described as homophobic lighting.
It's not the most flattering.
No, it is not flattering at all. And it makes everybody seem completely washed out and clinical. And I think, relevant to make the discussion of autism. One survey found that almost 85% of respondents experienced sensory barriers to accessing health services, with sensitivities to bright lights being highlighted as the number one barrier related to sensory barriers. Likewise, over 90% reported that anxiety linked to healthcare environments was a challenge to accessing care. Now, all of this that I just described, yes, there are attitudinal barriers around regarding ableism, but a lot of this also concern barriers of physical design, universal design, which is why having that whole of government approach will really help effectuate the structural reforms we need for these structural problems. This is not just about more doctors who know what autism is. This is also about ensuring that, you know, the lighting is gay friendly and autism friendly.
It's a necessity, right?
Oh, 100%. You know, you want to feel fabulous when you look fabulous.
Well, I mean, almost like, you know, somewhat of a humorous segue, but when you know, I guess the root of feeling fabulous, or what feeling fabulous means for you, is you feel empowered to do something, you feel more switched on, you feel more ready to do something. When it comes to the access that these buildings can provide and the disability awareness that these buildings then therefore need to be created in, as well as, you know, work culture, and then from the health and mental health span, and like you said, into department disciplinary changes. When it comes to those recommendations and the hopeful changes that they then become or have within the world to mitigate the adverse situations that many autistic people are subject to, which, like you said before, therefore have this ramification of mental health. And like you said, the 90% figure around anxiety that these environments, particularly health service environments, create. When it comes to those changes, and I know that in your experience, you've obviously experienced both the negative and the positive of when they, you know, those elements. I'm sort of jumping on my words a little, around on my words a little, but what does that mean for you when accessing healthcare and being able to aptly or appropriately report and discuss and take in the services that are provided? What does that mean from an empowerment perspective or disempowerment perspective?
I think for me, being a proudly queer and disabled person, for me, that is about understanding the social and human rights model of disability. Now, I know that's a mouthful, so I'll try to explain what I mean by that. Traditionally, there is the medical model of disability, which implies that disability or impairment arises from the individual's condition, health diagnosis, which is what disables them. For example, the medical model of disability would argue that a deaf person can't go to the cinema because they're deaf. The social and human rights model of disability argues that disability, much like gender, is not merely biological, but is actually sociological insofar as it's a sociologically constructed interaction between a person and the world around them. I know that's a bit academic-y.
No, but I think that that's a really great way of putting it. I mean, most recently, there's been a real surge in having, you know, to continue the disability of deafness. There has been a real surge in the accessibility at concerts for deaf people, where I think most famously there was that video of, I think it was Megan Thee Stallion or Doja Cat or someone like that. The interpreter was signing and doing dance moves along with it. And obviously, like, the song WAP really, like, it was quite humorous to see that happening. But that meant that a deaf individual was, by medical standards, was unable to attend a concert, but by social standards or social models, they were able to, because us as a society and those individuals that are leading society, like celebrities or artists or people like that, not just those decision makers, see that as their problem to change and to address, and therefore create those accessibility moments.
Well, under the social and human rights model of disability, a deaf person can't go to the cinema, not because they're deaf, but because there's no closed captioning. The social and human rights model of disability says that disability arises when a person with a chronic health condition interacts with an inaccessible environment that disables them. It's the interaction between a quote-unquote impairment and the world around them that gives a rise to that disability. That disability is not a phenomenon that emerges in a vacuum or intrinsically from the person. What this model does is shifts the onus of navigating the world with a disability away from solely the disabled person or the person with disability, and shifts that onus onto society to start doing better. I'll use the gender as a social construct analogy to help color the spaces a little bit more. Let's say there is a trans parent, right? A trans woman, and she has adopted a child, and she is going to a parent-teacher interview. And she's at the parent-teacher interview. Do you really think the teachers are going to say, oh, like, biological parents go here, non-biological parents go there? No, you're a parent. If you assume the role of a parent, then you are a parent. Similarly, ideas around gender are constructed because we have made those assumptions. And ideas around disability are also constructed and assumed. I've gone on dates with guys before who've said to me, wait, you're autistic, but you don't sound autistic to me.
And it's like, what does autism sound like to you?
Oh, yeah. And I quit back with, well, you don't sound like an arsehole to me, and yet you are what you are, and I am what I am. So here we are. I've also got on dates with guys before who've told me, when they found out that I'm autistic, that, wait, are we even allowed to be intimate? Isn't that illegal? Don't you need to get a permission form or something?
Oh my gosh.
Yes, the level of, I think, ignorance in our community, not just regarding autism, but I would say disability as a whole, the stigma is quite high. I think, to me, that intersection between disability rights and mental health advocacy is never more prevalent than it is when it comes to the fight against stigma. People have these assumptions in their heads of what a certain diagnosis means, and they are unable to reconcile with the fact that, hang on, maybe it's my assumptions of that condition that actually disable the person, rather than the condition being inherently this awful, terrible thing. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, being autistic is all hunky-dory. you know, I would very much love the ability to eat certain spicy foods.
Don't worry. I can't even eat certain spicy foods. Some days ketchup's too spicy.
Hey, yeah, and exactly. And I would love some days where I don't have, you know, sensory sensitivities. But I've gotten to a place, and many autistic people have too, where we don't hate ourselves anymore. We've accepted who we are, and rather than attempting to quote-unquote cure ourselves or to quote-unquote treat the condition, we instead have shifted to a learning to manage the impact of the condition. And you learn to live with what you have and learn to eventually love and accept yourself. To me, that is how I access the empowerment that you have mentioned earlier. I think when you are a person with disability, whether you're a person with psychosocial disability, which is a disability that arises from lived experience of mental ill health, or you have a physical disability, or you have an autoimmune condition, when you're a person with a chronic health condition of any kind, you have to learn to self-advocate, and you have to know your rights, and you have to trust your gut. You know, if your gut is telling you, hey, maybe this doctor thinks that, you know, ADHD is something only boys have. Maybe if this doctor thinks that, you know, you can't possibly have OCD because they think everyone with OCD is Brie Vandekamp from Desperate Housewives, then maybe you should change doctors and have the courage to change doctors. And it's not easy for all of us, and it's not accessible for all of us either, but it's about backing yourself and knowing that you are the most important person in your life when it comes to your healthcare.
I think that's really huge. And, you know, stigma is synonymous with mental ill health. And I guess, like you were saying, any form of disability, whether it be physical, psychosocial, etc. And one of those things, I guess, is, like you said, the self-advocation that needs to be met, or you need to take that on yourself. But that only comes through self-acceptance and understanding, I guess, those positive sides and those negative sides, not just internally, but externally with the world that you interact with. When it comes to, you know, you're seeking help, and you've sort of touched on it a little bit already, but when you're seeking help and you turn up at a service, whether it be a primary or secondary service, it could be, you know, a private psychiatrist or psychologist, or it could be someone through CAMHS, which is Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, for anyone who, you know, is unaware, or even Headspace or a GP. When it comes to those services and the access to advocate for yourself, are there any tools that you've found helpful when doing that, that have helped you minimize the damage or the mental health effects, like anxiety or you know, those traumatic experiences that is so often reported? Are there any sort of hip tips that you have found work for you, and maybe other people who might be listening could take up in their own sort of self-advocation for better mental health services, but generally better health services as well? Tricky question.
No, definitely. Yeah, it's an easy question. Don't worry. Not difficult at all. Autistic people can make jokes sometimes. Don't worry. We do have a sense of humor, contrary to popular belief.
You've already shown that with references like homophobic lighting and Brie Vandekamp, and it's grand.
For the straight people listening to this podcast, Brie Vandekamp is the Monica Geller of Desperate Housewives.
That's a really good cross comparison. I like that.
Got to learn how to translate for the straight people, because, you know, nothing wrong with being straight. I'm just wanting to clarify what Desperate Housewives is about as a show.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, where was I? Yes, tips and tricks.
Yes, yeah.
Well, contrary to what my ex-boyfriend has said about me, I am not a Disney princess, where I am not going to sit here and tell you that it's all sunshine and rainbows. It is, unfortunately, a situation in Australia that we actually don't have a lot of those resources and a lot of those toolkits and frameworks to help young autistic people. The reason why we had a disability royal commission, and we've had so many inquiries into the life outcomes of autistic young people, is because there is an epidemic of mental ill health, of discrimination, of assault, inequity experienced by autistic Australians within Australia. Now, for me, what I found has helped me is, honestly, a lot of it is my queerness. Strangely enough for me, it was actually a lot of the resources and a lot of the narratives around queerness, specifically queer pride and chosen family, that have actually assisted me the most. I'm a firm proponent of intersectionality because I have seen how lessons learned from one community can actually help another community, and how, for me, my identity as a queer, autistic, disabled person of color is not, my identity is not an obstacle. It can actually be my greatest asset. In queer communities, we often talk about how pride is the rejection of shame. It's about accepting who you are and about the coming out process of when you are in a safe place surrounded by people who love and accept you, coming out in a staggered way that feels true to who you are. Similarly to me, I had to come out twice as a queer person and as an autistic person. And ironically enough, it was the second one that was significantly harder for me. But I think it would have been even harder if it wasn't for the homophobia I've experienced. And that's really awful to say, but because I've been through the rigmarole of queer phobia, I kind of knew what could help me navigate ableism. It's not a one-for-one. And ableism in my life has been significantly more challenging than homophobia has been, but I'm grateful for the chosen family I have and the experiences that I've had in queer joy, because queer joy and pride has given me the conduit to access disability pride, autistic joy, and autistic self-acceptance. So my greatest advice is try to live a life that's most authentic to yourself. Find people who love and accept you for who you are. Understand that chosen family can be just as legitimate a form of family as any other type of family. And that you may not be able to change who you are, but you can definitely change how you're living your life. And oh gosh, doesn't this sound like, you know, a podcast about queer rights all of a sudden?
Well, I think the thing that you've picked up on specifically is the fact that there is such a similarity between the two because of the social inacceptance and discrimination. And like you said, the intersectionality has really empowered you to be your own advocate and to pine and use your voice, you know, even in a situation like this or in a social situation, like you mentioned before, when dating and being like, look, I'm going to call out your behavior. You're being a real turd about this.
I would even go further by saying that where disability rights are right now are where, you know, queer rights were maybe 10, 15 years ago, where I think we still have a lot more fight that we have to undertake for our queer brothers and sisters and non-binary pals. There is still rampant discrimination, especially discrimination experienced by trans people, especially trans people from First Nations communities, trans people with disability. I'm not going to sit here and say that queer phobia has been defeated. What I will say, though, is that societal acceptance of, let's say, homosexuality has progressed much further than its societal acceptance of disability rights has. I know a lot of people with psychosocial disability, a lot of people who are autistic, who haven't come out at their work. The Senate Select Committee on Autism report noted that in one study, 3 out of 4 autistic students didn't even disclose their autism to their university out of fear of reprisal. We have a lot further to go in terms of disability rights and autism acceptance. I think what's encouraging for me is that we know what the pathway forward is. The pathway forward with any civil rights movement is framing it in the lens of human rights, through the lens of equity, through the lens of legislation. It's not about throwing more money at the problem. It's about understanding that without equality for all, you will have equality for none. The gay rights activists, the queer rights activists, women's rights activists, the Black Lives Matter movement, all of them took to the streets at some point in history because they had a cause which compelled them to speak up. When there are inequitable life outcomes and systemic discrimination in education, employment, health, at a certain point, it becomes undeniable and irreconcilable to continue the status quo. And we had that moment with the disability community. We are still having that moment where many NDIS participants, many people of disability did take to the streets and they did call for a Disability Royal Commission. And we had that truth-telling moment. The Disability Royal Commission has now handed down 220 recommendations, including the creation of a Disability Rights Act, including strengthening the Disability Discrimination Act to prohibit vilification on the basis of disability. The Disability Royal Commission has recommended education ministers, for example, create a core capabilities framework to begin the process of implementing more equity into our education systems. We've had recommendations regarding retaining more leaders with disability in our boards, in our companies, in our institutions. The question now is, are we as a society willing to start listening to those recommendations, implementing those recommendations, or will this commission be yet another strategy that sits on the shelf, like the Aged Care Royal Commission or the Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody of Aboriginal People? So that was a very long answer and a way of saying that we still have a lot more work to do. And I think the work that needs to be done is actually listening to the community, implementing that intersectional approach, and understanding that policies about a community should be written by and for that community. The nothing about us without us principle.
Look, I think that's a great note to end on. And also, you know, that idiom kind of bookends this episode, nothing about us without us. And when it comes to the navigation, the accessibility, the care provided, and also the sustaining of that care, like you mentioned, throughout lives, I guess in the hope that those suicide rates, those shorter lifespans, the mortality collected data, that can be lessened and we can provide as a society, not just as a medical sort of model, like you were saying, but more of a human rights, social human rights sort of model, we can provide a greater space for individuals with autism and individuals accessing services of mental ill health or for mental health, particularly when it comes to allowing the greatest opportunity for wellness and recovery or remission and being able just to live like most other people are able to live, those privileged individuals of our society. So, and this has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me to have this conversation with you. I would like to encourage anyone who's interested in participating in the National Autism Strategies development, or you know, anyone who is interested in being an ally to this ongoing activism effort, to engage with the current consultations, which I'm sure Samuel can put in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, I would encourage people to celebrate the month of significance for our community. So October, which is when we're recording, is ADHD Acceptance Month.
We'll be releasing this month as well, so in a few days' time.
Yeah, and November is Neurodiversity November. And before you know it, we will be in Autism Acceptance Month the next year. And I would say that it's during those months, especially during April, which is National Autism Acceptance Month, I would really try to pay attention to the community, especially neurodivergent people with lived experience of mental ill health, and asking ourselves those hard questions such as, what can we be doing better? And how can we do that? And I am, you know, maybe I am a Disney princess. I do have hope that things will get better. We saw it in the UK. They have a national autism strategy that is helping pave the way. And my hope is that we'll get there one day as well. You know, now cue the Alan Menken music.
Thank you so much. This has been so wonderful, like I said. And I think that the more we have these conversations, the more we're able to better address these challenges, and we can implore our decision makers to actually pull up and support. So thank you, thank you, thank you.